Hello and welcome to Scoppy Radio. My name is Dan Johansson.
And I'm Maureen Smith.
And we have a very special... It feels like something should go there.
No, there's nothing.
All right, we have a very special, a treat, if you will, episode for you today. We have Andre Vasquez with us.
Hi there. Thanks for having me on the podcast.
Yeah, of course.
It's our pleasure.
We met at a Reclaim Chicago event maybe 3 months ago or something like that. Maybe longer. I don't know how time works now.
Sure. I have no idea.
It works. 2017, yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty nuts, yeah. Do you recall which event it was? Just some.
It was
infighting.
It was
who
Fritzy's.
Are we fighting? Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Which I love that, and I kind of love, and this is already kind of like getting into a potential tangent, but I also just love that about the social media presence that you cultivate, which is one that is very open to the idea of discourse,
yes.
And discussion, and the idea of like we all come from. To these things from different perspectives and have different reasons behind the way that we think about things.
Yeah, absolutely. And, like, yeah. I mean, that was the name of the event was Drinks and Discourse.
Right.
It was very much about, I look at a lot of things from the perspective like how I first started becoming politically active, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like 2 years ago, I don't know that I'd be anywhere near the point where I am now as far as like discussing it and organizing all these events. And I think about that when we put together events, that people want to have these conversations, but it's very easy to feel intimidated,
mm-hmm.
right? You walk into these spaces where everyone's either a policy wonk or some college-educated, like, activist,
mm-hmm.
and if you're your regular just neighbor who wants mm-hmm. to find out something, like, how do you walk in there and just engage in conversation but not immediately feel intimidated and, like, just turn around?
Right? Yeah.
I think creating that kind of environment where people can just like ask whatever questions they have discussions about what they don't know, disagree. Like, I think that stuff is healthy, and it feels like when the overwhelming narrative is that politics is taboo
mm-hmm.
and we don't talk about that stuff, it's a lot easier to keep everybody divided.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. And I think that the thing that you kind of talk about there too, about the idea of there being a learning curve to these conversations, is super interesting too, especially in light of before we started recording, we were talking about how understanding how city level politics works
mm-hmm.
Can be very difficult, which I think is a great segue into your running for alderman.
That is the plan.
Yes,
I've been very deliberate in like the wording of it. So.
For sure.
There's a lot that goes into actually running, like the filing mm-hmm. and the fundraising. That is my plan, barring any kind of like personal or life tragedy.
For sure.
And a lot of it really entails talking to neighbors first and foremost to find out
mm-hmm.
like what their concerns are, what their vision for the ward is. Because I think it's easy for people to just say like, I'm going to run and let me just carry the ward on my back or the city on my back. And fundamentally, I and the organization I work with, Reclaim Chicago, believe that that's probably not the best way to think of government, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like that communities really should be the ones that hold that power, and your elected official represents that. Like, they're a conduit
mm-hmm.
to get that done.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't hear that a lot. I think the narratives when people are running are always like, trust in me, I can do it, I'm the guy or girl or female.
Right.
Woman. So I gotta fix all the...
Yeah.
Descriptors there. But yeah, I think we get fed that so much through media and like everywhere else that people assume that you got to pick this one person, and
mm-hmm.
we see how that doesn't work out all the time, if that's the thinking.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's, it brings up a lot like the idea of like identity-based campaigning versus policy-based kind of campaigning.
Yeah.
Which I think is also a very like important place for... that there needs to be more uniting of. Because I think the idea that you can't have both of those things is silly.
Yes, it's this either-or thing that, like...
Yeah.
You know, and that's why we've been using more terminology lately of, like, really what some of the problems are. Like, when I talk in front of groups, I use terms like shared oppression, right? Like, like across different identities that people, like, categorize themselves as, there's a level of oppression. Like, you can be... an old white male, there is going to be a level at even which you've been oppressed.
Mm-hmm.
And when people look at it as this competition of like, no, I'm way more oppressed. Yes, there's absolute validity to that. But if we understand that it's... That's right, hit the notes.
I didn't realize that the piano got opened. We shut it before.
That's cool. It felt like one of the old, like, old-timey radio shows where, like, right before I talked, the mood music kicked in.
Yeah. Except it's, like, weird atonal cat.
Yeah. This is all... But this idea that, like, we aren't competing across, like, these identities. Mm-hmm. And I think that's... It is a very difficult conversation because there's a lot of value to saying, like, identity politics do matter, right? Mm-hmm. As does class politics and understanding that economic things matter across the board.
Mm-hmm.
It should never be an either or. It's really about respecting and understanding both, and like every single possible way that people can divide us, they do. Even if it's mm-hmm. something where we're both like progressive, it's still like, no, but this is the right way. You know, this is, and we just don't move forward that way. It's just very mm-hmm. difficult to get anything accomplished.
Yeah. Well, would you mind telling us a bit about Reclaim?
Yeah. So, I think I was trying to figure out the best way to start.
For sure. The, like, elevator pitch?
Yeah. I mean, okay, elevator pitch. Thank you. That actually clarified. No. So, like, no, because I was going into, like, this is how I met Reclaim, and this is the whole... but, no, I mean, at root, it's very much an organization that was... put together by two other organizations, the People's Lobby and National Nurses United, right?
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so Reclaim Chicago is kind of a creation of both of those organizations, and I believe some of it is legal, right? If it's a C4, depending on what kind of organization, mm-hmm. they're allowed to do electoral work or mm-hmm. political work or not.
That's what we've been running into in terms of trying to figure out if we want to go the nonprofit route, was like, we want to endorse people, so that gets rid of 501c3 right there.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Even me, when I was starting to work with, like, putting together Chicago Progress, it got to a point that I'm like, well, do I make it an LLC so that no one can say anything, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. But that's where Reclaim kind of started. So what they do, or what we do, is really get that point across when we're organizing folks, when we're looking for candidates, when we're talking about what candidates we're going to be endorsing. It's really... kind of three big criteria that I think help describe it. One is understanding people that have, or that they have progressive values that we do, meaning you're putting people first above profit. Like, that's mm-hmm. just super clear, non-negotiable, right? That there's just also this idea of co-governing, which is, I kind of alluded to earlier, right? That people who should be leading should come from those communities and work together with the communities to kind of get goals accomplished.
Mm.
And third, it being like this idea of path to victory. Like, having the progressive values is necessary. Coming from the communities is vital. But if you're not taking yourself seriously as a candidate and building the kind of base made of community members to actually run an effective campaign, you're kind of... What are we talking about, right? Like, so mm-hmm. so Reclaim has been very clear about organizing people and training organizers and doing campaign leadership schools to get people to think that way about government. And when I was first introduced to the organization was because I put together a fundraiser as, like, this semi-retired rapper who wanted to do a fundraiser for Bernie. And I was like, I need to make sure I pack the crowd. So let me find some community organizers to get more people that actually pay attention to stuff to show up, because I put some money to kind of throw this event
right,
and it could go wrong. So I met Amanda Weaver, who's the executive director, after the fundraiser. She kind of talked to me and was like, well, what's your plan after this, like, fundraiser? And I didn't have much. I thought this was, like, a huge accomplishment at that time myself.
Mm-hmm.
And she explained that, like, I was already community organizing, whether I knew it or not, and invited me to go to formally train. Mm-hmm. So to me, it always feels like, probably weird, it always feels like I got invited to be one of the X-Men or something. Like, they're like, yeah, come on in, and, like, this is what we do. Welcome to the training. And and that just made it a lot clearer for me about what my actual power can be in the community and how we can all come together to build that.
Yeah.
That was a long elevator pitch, but...
No. it was great. Yeah, this is why I'm such a bad live journalist. Like, I can never be on TV or anything like that, because I always get, like, five tangents that we could potentially go on, and then I'm like, well, I gotta pick one.
We can go all out.
Ask five questions at once.
I can try to manage. You can try to five, and I'll see if, like...
Yeah.
It's like the speed round.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm interested definitely in how universal the idea of community organizing can really be. Like, mm-hmm. I think that in a... Well, and I think especially in the way that, you know, coming from an arts background yourself, and, you know, we come from an arts background, and right. I think we're really kind of better understanding the idea of what community organizing should and can look like, can and should, whatever. But it's interesting, you know, I'm curious both how your experience as an artist influenced your experience as an organizer.
Yeah, absolutely.
And how your and the other way around too, because I know that you also have been coming back to the idea of working in the arts a little bit. I saw a random post about.
Yes, absolutely. It's actually a very good question. I think the things that I learned as an artist about like promoting what I'm working on and like mm-hmm. building what at that, you know, what's analogous to it would be a fan base, right? Mm-hmm. So you're building that just as an artist. You're trying to get the word out. You want people to follow it. You want to get like, it's just, you learn these traits and these behaviors. And I was like most people, I assume, that when you hear the term community organizing, you kind of don't know what it means,
mm-hmm.
right? It's like a pretty vague term, and you hear, like, I would imagine where people most often get that reference is when we think of President Obama being a community organizer.
That's exactly what I was just going to say. Like, yeah. I was first introduced to the idea of being a community organizer. It was like, Barack Obama, community organizer from Chicago.
That's right. So all of a sudden, everybody in Chicago that, like, community organizes and has a hint of ambition is like, that's mm-hmm. the inside track.
Right? There's the path right there. Yeah.
Sign me up.
Right.
So when I first, I think that's why I didn't understand what community organizing was, even though I was doing it, right? All you're mm-hmm. really doing is bringing people together that believe in what you believe in, whether that be your art or whether that be, like, obviously in a political sphere, like some your values, and finding ways to get people to come together around it and create, like, a more of a long-term growth as opposed to, like, okay, we showed up to one event, we did mm-hmm. it, right? So it's like this ongoing thing, and it can take many forms, I think, which makes it a lot more difficult to like describe. Like mm-hmm. When I was thinking about to your point, like I always think about integrating like arts or media back into what we're doing. It really is about explaining that to folks who don't know. Like if you just hear the term community organizing, you're like, well, what does that mean?
Mm-hmm.
If we created like video content where you like talk to more community organizers as to why they do it, show some of the events that they're doing and like how they're organizing, you'd then have a much better fundamental understanding of it, and people mm-hmm. would feel like compelled to do something. Like, oh, maybe I can go to an event, or maybe I can go organize. Mm-hmm. So from coming from an artist background, understanding where like to survive, you've got to do some of that stuff, right? If you're an independent artist, you have to do that. And as a musician, like, because I was a rapper for a while, like, I was around when cassettes were around and they were gone. CDs were around, they were gone. Everything went digital and, like, record stores were closing.
Mm-hmm.
Then you go to streaming, right? So you had to become more resourceful as an artist to be heard and try to, like, survive out there, right? Because the major labels were not going to invest in, like, you know, I could be like, hashtag capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
But that transformed the way... you know, people got the word across about anything.
Mm-hmm.
Those skills and experience kind of lends itself to doing that in a community organizing sphere, right, world. But I think it's always the same thing. It's always when you try to cross over from one or the other, you feel like, I'm brand new to this world. Do I even know what I'm talking about to then engage and do this stuff, mm-hmm. right? I think at root, a lot of the organizing has been teaching people to do stuff that people knew how to do before we had smartphones, like talking to people on a one-on-one basis, asking questions,
right.
finding out where they're from, and like what we all kind of agree and share. So, yeah, I think that works.
Yeah, I think it's always interesting how much of it really just comes down to, I mean, because that's what we're finding is translating things that we'd figured out in like the 50s. Weirdly, as far as media is concerned, obviously there's like terrible things about earlier decades, but I mean like the comfort that folks found in radio back then,
right?
You know, like the comfort, the idea of having a...
Not even comfort, but just like the necessity of like, that was how they received their information
right.
most quickly.
Or like a non-oligarchical press.
Yeah.
Right, yeah.
Anyway.
But it's also like, because there's that, but there's also the, once we get to smartphones and the internet.
Yeah.
Where like, you don't have to walk outside of your four walls to have friends, to see what's going on, to engage and have these conversations and feel like you're a part of a community. Mm-hmm. You totally lose the aspect of like, do I even know my neighbor's names? Like, how mm-hmm. do we figure that kind of fundamental community, right? That gets removed from it. So I think, I think that it's like a, it's not a good and bad. It's about figuring out the balance of it. Like, I want to get that information that quickly on my phone and like learn this stuff, but I don't want to be so tied to it that I'm disconnected from like face-to-face conversation mm-hmm. with
right.
folks. Yeah.
Well, and I think that's an interesting thought into the idea of how ward strategic organizing is, because
yeah.
it is so neighbor to neighbor.
Right.
And that thought is so lost on the political moment right now.
Yes. Yes. Thanks, Trump. Before Trump, but thanks, Trump.
Yeah.
Because, like...
It really came to a, like, terrible head with Trump, I think.
Because Trump became, like, this target, right? So instead of focusing on, like, what's going on outside and my elected mm-hmm. official that I have direct access to and should be accountable to me, everyone's, like, waving their fist up at the White House, which is absolutely understandable.
Yeah.
But it keeps people's eyes off of, like, the real... potentially corrupt stuff that happens at our local level,
mm-hmm.
right? And it also shields some of the people that do that, because
mm-hmm.
they're able to say, like, I'm also against Trump. We're team resist Trump, right? So, like, totally don't pay attention to what we're doing right now.
Yeah.
That my anger at everything that happened in the election and a little bit before that, I chose to channel it at a very local level. Like, I want to see the results of what I'm
right.
doing. Yeah.
Sorry,
go ahead.
Because I think that, I mean, you know, 2017 was obviously, like, catastrophic on a humanitarian level federally.
Right.
But then look at all of the messed up, like, local stuff that went down. Like, Rahm ran amok. Rahner
yes.
ran amok.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, all of these potentially fruitful programs, all of these, you know, schools that were starting to kind of get a leg up or being gutted. And it's
yeah.
like, and it's because people, to your point, people are less focused on the local level. And it's, you know, Rahm gets away with murder because he also doesn't like Trump.
Right. Yeah. No, I mean, there was a moment where all this stuff was first going on where it was like resist Trump was like the huge thing, where I'm like, I almost viewed it like a video game. Like, that's like your top boss, but you've got to beat the little bosses to get up.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, Rahm's one of those, Rahner's one of those, and like, you have to look and be, it's almost like it's exercise. You're developing your skills at this democracy by targeting and going up higher. Like,
mm-hmm.
you know, I hate, sometimes I have to be very careful about how I word things. I'm
For
not
sure.
the biggest fan of petitions, right? I think that depending on who the petitions are for and what the issue's about, people feel really good about doing it. But, like, are we going to get enough signatures to get Trump to do anything that we
mm-hmm.
would want to have accomplished?
Well, and then let's say that we get 1 million signatures and we slap it on his desk. Like, he's going to push it it's going to be on top of his remote control, and then he's going to brush it aside and turn on Fox News.
Right,
like,
so it's things like that, like... I really look at but back to your point about, like, at the local level, like, these are all things that were happening prior to Trump and everything. So it's just that people, for a lot of different reasons, aren't aware of it,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, people are busy worrying about paying their rent, living
mm-hmm.
check to check, like, multiple jobs, school, you know, school debt. Like,
mm-hmm.
you're carrying so much of this stuff that really, how much bandwidth do people have? Even when it's something that fundamentally affects all of it,
yeah.
right? Plus, people get, you know, disillusioned because you see how, you know, and I think some of that led to Trump, that if you've been paying attention for the last couple decades, your life really hasn't gotten better, and that's under both parties, mm-hmm. right? So, like, I think when it came to this last election, people who were really hurting were just like, a pox on both houses. None of you guys have taken care of me. I just mm-hmm. want whatever's not the establishment politician. And because the options they then got in the general election were someone who was very much an establishment politician and then this psycho gorilla with a grenade, mm-hmm. People were just like, I give up, like, whatever. And even those small margins mm-hmm. cause us to be where we're at now. Yeah, when we're talking about, like, the shutting down of schools and mental health centers, right? When we're talking about the fact that they're willing to offer $2.25 billion in cuts to bring Amazon over, mm-hmm. but then tell us we mm-hmm. don't have enough funding for schools, right? Like,
or, like, trying to open a cop academy, but we don't have enough money for schools.
And you get 49 mm-hmm. of the aldermen voting for it, and only mm-hmm. Alderman Rosa and the 35th voting against it, right? So a lot of that people don't pay attention to because so much else going on, but they're starting to because mm-hmm. of how crazy that election just was. So that's a good place to start from. But yeah, there's things like that. Like the Cop Academy one to me was like shocking. Mm-hmm. But that just tells you that they're not feeling pressure from the outside to like vote one way or the other.
Well, and it says so much about the power of the division of the rural versus the urban. And that's a huge thing in Illinois. Where, because we have such a rich rural community and but we also have such a rich and vibrant and, like, very extremely, I would say even more so than, like, New York or L.A. maybe, like, of progressivism.
Yeah.
And I mean, like, economic progressivism. It's so ingrained in what Chicago is about. But that's the thing is, like, for the poor, like, there are poor in rural areas and in urban areas. And the things that are bothering them, the things that they care about at their core, are way more similar than they are different.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And, like, that's where the part where, you know, for people who have critiques about identity politics have a really valid point. If mm-hmm. you're splitting up that, like, broke is broke.
Yes.
Right? That when you start making this case of like, oh, and the white rural voters, it's like, no, people feel that if they're part of this country, they should have the opportunity and access to like be able to have a shelter and like be able to like get food. But more importantly, or equally as important, that their children have a better opportunity than they did. Mm-hmm. And I would unfortunately bet most people don't, right? Most people don't feel confident that their kids are going to have it better than they are. And like, that's very much at root the reason why I started organizing and the reason why I plan on running. Because mm-hmm. if my kids... So the way this is in Chicago, the way it's set up, is over time, like, the public schools are underfunded, which then caused parents to go, I love Chicago, but I'm not going to have my kid go to this school, so let's go move to the suburbs and figure that out.
Set up a voucher program.
Right. That's a whole... Ooh.
Yeah, sorry, yeah.
Like, because I have a 2-year-old and 4-year-old, so we just started being informed about, like, the process for even going into, like, public school mm-hmm. for our daughter who's going to be going to kindergarten.
My cousins all went up through the Chicago public school system, and like even and actually there have been changes in terms of that acceptance process.
Yes.
Because I have 2 cousins who are now post college, and then their younger brother is applying to high schools right now. Mm-hmm. And the process for when Maddie and Brendan were applying to high school was they applied to high schools. It was like college. They applied to high schools, and then they got accepted to a couple, and then they chose.
Right.
The process now is that you make a list of whichever, yes. and it's in order of which school you want to go to. Mm-hmm. And then all of the schools that you apply to see the full list. And, like, the administration of that school could be, like, salty.
I'm your fifth. I'm not your first.
Exactly. So like, right. And so they want to accept you. And then whatever school accepts you, you have to go there.
Yeah. So, like, learning about it for our kids through grade school was like,
is it the same process?
No, so it's a little bit more similar to what you were first saying, as far as like I applied to like 16 of them. Mm-hmm. Okay. We did for our daughter. But it was a very depressing introduction to it. Even the people introducing it were kind of depressed and saying it, because it very much feels like there's this like slice of cheese and we'll put it at the end of the maze, and like you guys all figure out which one of you can actually get to this like limited resource. Mm-hmm. Right. And so when you're looking at it, and this is what's I get very, like, really upset about is that, so you build this dynamic where people, like, live here, it's getting more expensive to live here, then you have your kids, and you're like, I don't know what I'm going to get, depending on what school they can get into, so maybe it's in my best interest to just, like, pack my stuff up, go find somewhere else to live that has a school that I feel comfortable about.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that works almost, like, hand in hand for what, you know, the elite capitalist class wants in the city, mm-hmm. right? Like, cool, get out, because that way we can get more people to come in that are more affluent, or like who people want to pay for their kids to live in the mm-hmm. city, right? Then they're bringing that income and they get to further gentrify like neighborhoods, mm-hmm. right? So it's not in their best interest to fully fund schools, right? If it was, it would be happening.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But it's not, like, and it's their best interest to keep this like influx of people coming in and out, right? It's like an engine for what they think maintains yes. revenue, even though they'll tell you the city's broke, but when mm-hmm. they need money, they're willing to say, Amazon, like, what can I give you for you guys to come over?
Mm-hmm.
So it's dynamics like that that we need people in office to automatically call out and say, like, no, like, if you're somebody who lives in the city, to be honest, school should be one of the first things we're funding, because when you're looking at like violence across the city, like, rather than having a reactive solution of like we need more cops on the streets, we should be having more education opportunities and resources mm-hmm. especially in the neighborhoods that don't have it, right? Like on the south and west sides, which would then help really fundamentally change that and provide more opportunity and make the place safer for everyone, have more resources from people that live here that make the city better. But nobody talks about that. It's all like, sure. no, we don't have enough, and like, but if downtown needs something or Lincoln Park needs something, like, let's get the checkbook.
Well, and right? it's an interesting thing, and it's something that that's dawning, and it has been dawning on me, but I'm finding the words for it now of, you know, I know for me, the folks that moved, that I went to school in Chicago, I moved to Chicago to go to Roosevelt to get my master's, which, so like, right there, take that as a preface of what I'm saying is, like, I come from the folks that I moved here with is a privileged background. I mean, I was lower income, but that I, you know, I got like, I'm not going into the depths of my life and all that shit. But like, my point being here is that, to your point, there is this influx of folks that come to Chicago that are liberal leaning folks. Like, and I'm talking about like folks that probably voted for Hillary and but have no, they can't get around the learning curve of understanding how poorly set up Chicago schools are. They can hear, oh, Chicago schools are set up a certain way, but there are local levels of Democratic Party failures that are potentially overlooked yeah. because folks move here and they weren't kids here, or they weren't raising kids here.
Right.
I'm kind of, so I guess my...
So there's layers to that, right? Like, because I think I know you're getting it, because I've seen, and I, obviously, like, I do a lot of, like, Facebook conversations around stuff like this, so you get to see, like, those divides between people who identify as, like, liberal
right.
and progressive.
Right.
Right.
It's,
right.
Yeah, it's very much about, like, exposure to different cultures and, like, really living with, like, people that are different from, like, the environments that people have grown up in, right? Because somebody could be, quote-unquote, liberal and, like, understand the ideas, but they don't have the same visceral urgency mm-hmm. to change things,
yeah.
right? They'll say, yeah, we definitely need to be more equal, and like, I believe that, and we should, and like, absolutely, right? Like, nobody disagrees with that.
Mm-hmm.
I think what the issue is that when you look at people who really are from marginalized communities, they've got the sense of urgency of like, yeah, this isn't just about acknowledging a problem. This is about like, fundamentally changing things, and it's not about, you know, just because somebody's got a, you know, the Democrat jersey on that all of a sudden they're on our team. Like, they're not looking out for us either, because they think like, they think we can wait. Mm-hmm. That's the problem, right? Is that people are like, oh, I mean, I know it's a problem and we're working on it, but it's just, we have this incrementalism platter. You should totally like check this out.
Well, but then yeah. like the kids who are gonna then move through the system during this you know, incremental growth, like, what about them? Like, sure, the kids 10 years from now, after the carefully thought out plan right. is executed are going to possibly benefit. That is, if the
and
if
even,
the
yeah.
if the budget isn't reallocated to another project.
Right, like even that's more optimistic than I get, right? Because if you're plotting this like 10-year plan of how to slowly get there, you're not taking into account that the people who don't want it to happen will shut it down immediately, right? They're not going to wait for you to figure out what year 10 looks like on a plan.
Well, there was the plan to have minimum wage come up to $15 by X year, and you know, and it had started when I am a minimum wage worker. I'm a barista, and when I first moved to Chicago, my first job was $10 an hour at a coffee shop downtown, and then every year my pay went up 50 cents and now, you know, and I'm above minimum wage now, thankfully, but I, you know, who's to say that's not gonna stop that incremental growth? Is because I think that city minimum wage is 11 right now, or possibly 11.50, I don't know, but you know, Rauner just shut that down, so you know, in the next year, are we going to see that still increase?
And it's also folks that we identify as our team shutting it down, right?
Exactly.
Like,
you know,
people saying 15, but like not in certain places because that would be too destructive to the local economy. So we should start at like 13. And like, you know, it's people who like really believe or want other people to believe that that's the only way things can get solved, right? Not understanding that if people were getting paid more for the work they do, that money goes right back into the economy, right? Like economies, you know, are partially driven by demand more often than like, they are very much driven by demand and not by job creators, quote unquote, right? Like, it's like if someone wants a product or a service and they're investing their money to do it, that drives the business to then meet that demand. If people don't have disposable income to then even express that demand by going to shop, right, then where are we going? It's stagnant. So, yeah.
My pet peeve in terms of, and this is kind of a tangent, but it just harkens on the point of progressivism, is that my pet peeve is that I've worked for countless companies that their main goal is expansion. They open up a shop and their end game is to
be a national brand.
Is to compete with Starbucks or compete with whoever. And so any profits they turn, any dividends that they get are invested in the company's growth,
right,
where it would be better suited to reinvest in your workers.
Yes.
Like if you know, in your first 6 months, you're doing better than projected or if you're on track or whatever, like instead of, you know, saving up money, you know, instead of like, you know, approaching another lender to open up another location so you can hire more workers at a lower rate. Instead, boost everybody's hourly up $2.
Right. Well, that's the reason why people get away with that is, you know, and a lot of it is, you know, history book knowledge, which that can get slanted. But there were times where owners would do that, right? Like they would definitely share into that with whatever their employees were and kind of grow. But like that model is at this point feels archaic, right?
Yeah.
Like everything's driven by profit if you're running a business. Now, the issue too, though, to be completely fair and nuanced, is like you've got these smaller businesses, right? These mom and pop chains of people who are just like a lot of us, just don't want to have a boss and maybe want to have a real passion about what they want to do and have their own business, right? On both sides, we've got to be very clear about that divide. Because what happens is you get a lot of people who are very progressive who will quickly demonize anyone that owns a business, regardless of the level of that, right? And the way I view it is if you're not nuanced about that conversation, what you're in effect doing is you're giving larger corporations defense, right? Like a larger corporation could be like, can you believe they're doing this to all our businesses? And they prop up the smaller ones, right? The mom and pops, when it's really not the enemy, right? It's understanding that, and this is kind of what brought me to really thinking about democratic socialism, right? I mean, Bernie brought me to start paying attention to it. And then as I was like really latching on the values and understanding that fundamentally that is very much more in line to how I view things, it's an understanding that corporations can be horrible and evil and yes. Not the argument, right? a business in itself, one should treat as neither good nor bad. It just, it, what it does is it creates profit. It's what it's built to do. It's almost like a law of its nature.
Yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
That is what it is. Then as a government, what we should be doing is saying, understanding that that's what they are. They drive revenue. They're engines for revenue. We, as a government, what we're in charge of doing is making sure that out of the money that that's being made, we are then taxing it at a rate that allows us to provide for social public goods and services, right?
Mm-hmm.
People should have homes. Education should be funded. Minimum wage should be, you know, where it should be, where it is now. So the government, at that point, isn't really good, bad either. Like, if you want to play this out, that's your role. Our role is to make sure that you are paying these taxes because we're providing this government and this, like, country here to be able to, for you to run that business. It should be clear cut, and that should be the case, but it's never made that way.
And the thing that's super, this is super interesting, and I'm gonna, it's very relevant to what we're working on with Scoppy right now, and I'm gonna try very hard to not talk too much about that because that's not fair. But, like, the thing, it's very interesting to think about, because when you even think about, like, how a private enterprise should really be doing that and thinking about profits and thinking about, at least you should be taking care of your workers.
Right.
At least, like, you, like, of course, like, it should move to the level of, let's think about taxation and think about the public good and think about it at a governmental level. But, like, if all businesses at their core are a management of cost to produce and the profit and the surplus of that cost, what businesses are doing with that surplus is crucial. And that's where we're thinking now about, because in the next year or two, we decided to not do nonprofit. We're looking at a private enterprise, but that means that, you know, because I also am very much a democratic socialist, and right. what that means, where I think even the democratic socialist community,
even that's a spectrum, right?
Figuring out what that means.
That's right.
But for us, like, it's really coming to the point where, like, it's got to be a thing that is, there is a level of worker ownership.
Yes, absolutely.
The folks that are working have to be able to be part of, and in a level besides their hourly rate, what it is that the business is.
Yeah, because, I mean, so there's a couple things there. Like, we've seen that the model that's existing doesn't work for us.
Mm-hmm.
The income inequality gets larger and larger. These corporations that have all this capital are then able to influence the legislators that create the laws that would normally keep them in place, right? Like, they've learned to game the system. And so when people, like, bring up conversations about, like, how the free market should solve things, right? It's, like, it's a lie. There's no free market when you think about how cunning people with capital can be. Mm-hmm. Like, if I can set the rules for myself, there isn't a free market. I can tell you that that's what it is, right? And then you've got organizations who, like, with this surplus of funds, like you were alluding to, like, they're like, well, let me just donate it to a charity because I could then write it off. So ultimately, I'm taken care of, right? It's a big problem that we all accept that. And that idea crosses parties, right? There's Democrats who are like, that's exactly how it works. So we need to make sure that it works for us. And it's like, yes, the tax code should be changed, but do we trust any of the people up there to actually handle it? No.
Right? I mean, we've learned that now.
Yeah.
So I think the way you're thinking about it is right. It's like, when people start talking about building co-ops and you see community gardens and you see things like that, it's like, that's the kind of mindset that really is socialism, right? But people, depending on your generation, right, are averse to that term because of the historical references to it.
And it doesn't help when there are leftists that are, like, ironically posting communist memes and stuff.
That are like, yes.
Sorry, that is potentially, like, divisive and...
No, but it's different levels, right? Like, it's, I agree. It's very hard to have the conversations because people are dying and people are starving and people are hurting. And that's why people are angry and there's a lot of emotion and a lot of open wounds. And, like, they're not easy conversations to have. I think that goes back to, like, the drinks and discourse type of
thing. Right.
We still need to have the conversations and be understanding that we're not going to figure it all out. And we're not all going to be 100% right. In fact, none of us are probably 100% right. Like, I started using the term, like, we're all works in progress, right? Like, the person who I was 10, 20 years ago when I was a rapper, right? Mm-hmm. And, like, hip-hop music, for as empowering as it felt as a person of color, was still very homophobic, very misogynistic, mm-hmm. right? So, and I was a rapper. So, like, that was part of the world that I was in. And I was like, I feel like the strongest person in the world. And now I'm a battle rapper. So I'm screaming like the worst things possible to people and getting applauded for it, mm-hmm. right? That's nowhere near from the person I am now. Like, we've all evolved, hopefully. Some of us haven't. It's been pretty bad. But but it's the understanding that nobody comes out of the gate like the most woke person in the world,
mm-hmm.
right? And if we can accept that about each other and have genuine conversations, understand we got to meet people where they're at to then be able to move, then I think we get somewhere.
I agree. And I think that also really answers a question that I had earlier, which is, how do we get over that learning curve?
Yeah.
You know, of working through with people that maybe don't understand how these things really play out at the local level.
I would love to talk a little about specifically the 40th Ward.
Yeah, sure.
So you were, before we recorded, you were talking about how, you know, especially with how wards are figured out in terms of like their physical shape and stuff like that, that there's a lack of resonance as a community. I'm wondering if you could speak a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely.
That.
So like I said, I took that initial like frustration of like, what can I do, and wanted to focus very much like at a local level to kind of see the results
mm-hmm.
of any work that we're doing, whether we're organizing. So for me, it really broke down like, what's the smallest way to do that? And it made sense that the ward is the beginning of that conversation, right? Mm-hmm. Like, there are like local block clubs and neighborhoods and things like that. But what I would see is it was a lot of like different sides of the city having conversations, or the city as a whole, but not really at the ward level. Mm-hmm. Because to be honest, you could ask a room of like 20 people what ward they're from and two will answer, right?
Yeah.
Like, people don't think that way. And it's not made easy when you go online to try to figure this stuff out. Yeah, so the wards, like, there's 50 of them in the city, and I'd be hard-pressed to find one that's shaped in a normal fashion, like, any kind of shape, right? Like, mm-hmm. So when we think of, like, in a larger scheme, sense, when people talk about, like, gerrymandering, right? You can see that at a very local level when you see how the wards are, like, cutting in each other, or, like, what neighborhoods are what part of what ward, right?
Yeah.
So the 40th is shaped like a donut, because in effect, there's a Rose Hill Cemetery which takes up a lot of it that's in the center of the ward. Hmm. So I literally was just like, let me pull the map up and look at the geography and like figure out like, how do we like connect folks together so they can feel like a community? And that's just stuck out like a sore thumb, right? That because of that being there, there really is no central place that the whole ward could come together and have like town halls and meetings and discussions about like what ordinances people want to pass. There isn't a sense of identity, right? Nobody can say, like, it's hard to say and feel proud about being a 40th Ward neighbor mm-hmm. because you don't even know what that actually means. And I think that the alderman, and even that's a weird term, the city council member can create or work with the community to create an identity. Like, people know the 35th Ward because of what Alderman Carlos Rosa has, like, built as a democratic socialist, as a progressive. People take pride in that, right? People know the 49th Ward because it has a very like activist base. Like, they've got the Harlan Cafe and mm-hmm. a lot of organizations are very strong there, and some of the other wards don't. So when I looked at the 40th, it was really on one level bringing that community together. You're looking at Andersonville, Lincoln Square, Bowmanville, Rockwell. Like, there's so many other different neighborhoods that in thinking about how to really bring the ward together, it's almost like those are all little mini wards in a big ward that you gotta like combine and mm-hmm. and it's very strange, right? It's not how people think of like democracy and like, I've just got the greatest ideas and if I just, people can hear me.
Mm-hmm.
So really what we're doing is talking to neighbors and getting to find out like what not only are their values, but what are their concerns? What do they want to see in the ward? What's a vision for what that is? Because if you can help create that for folks or really organize them to build it as a community, it'd be pretty awesome, right? Like, if people knew the 40th Ward is like being like this, like there's community gardens everywhere, And it was like the small businesses had their own kind of like branding. So everyone knew it was like a 40th fest every year, right? Then you can start building consent. And if like people were really proud of like how diverse we are and like what we're doing to make it even more better and to provide opportunities, you would then get thing like an award that other awards would look at and be like, why do they get to do that? Like, mm-hmm. we could totally do that.
Yeah.
And then help multiply that across the city, mm-hmm. right? And I also think that, you know, I being someone who grew up in the city and like as a rapper, like visiting all parts of the city, we don't get enough North Side city council members that talk about the South and West Side and like how we need to invest for what they're doing. I think it's very easy for a lot of, I mean, I've seen it in my ward. It's easy for someone to say like, look, we're the safest ward here, and like mm-hmm. it's really great, and like look what we have. And when you start with that kind of thinking, how far away are you from like, we should build a wall?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, you're taking so much pride in like this small locale instead of looking at the whole picture. And I think we sometimes do that at a national level without looking at the globe. Sure. Right?
Yeah.
That it can be very easy to be manipulated into this kind of thinking that brought this like build a wall thing that mm-hmm. Trump had going on.
Mm-hmm.
So if we look at the wards that way, which they have historically, right? Like historically you'd have like these ward bosses and precinct captains, and they almost ran their whole thing like a feudal system. That we've got to change that. And that's, I mean, that's probably a little wonky and highbrow. Like now, it's really crazy. Because 2 years ago, I'd be like, I don't even know what we're talking about.
Yeah.
But now understanding that more, really what I'm keyed in on, and you mentioned it before, so as far as bringing the arts in and everything else, is like, if you've got a ward where 55,000 people live in and only 10,000 of them voted, right? That other 45,000, like, how do we just talk to folks so they're like, okay, I'll pay attention this time and like, I want to find out what I can do in my area.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a good place to start.
Cool.
Yep.
Awesome. Well, we have a few minutes left. So the last thing we do with all of our guests is a 1 minute plug for anything they have upcoming. And we also love hearing about, we love hearing shout outs of other folks that you think are doing dope work, and other media you're consuming, TV shows, movies, books, stuff like that.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks. We're always doing stuff. So like, you know, and a lot of it's based in the 40th Ward. So it's like, we do the drinks and discourse events once a month. I think we're taking a little bit of a break in December, but in January we're picking back up. That's usually like the third week of the month. We've got the Reclaim monthly meetings. We're starting to do a monthly canvas. What I'm actually working on building would be almost like a 40th Ward committee, right? Like really focused, so it isn't just like Reclaim North, but people see that.
Mm-hmm.
I've also been talking to folks that are supportive of CPAC, which is the Civilian Police Accountability Council.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got members in the 40th that I'm like, all right, let's see if we can build a committee there. So it's really a lot of that. I would say for anything we're doing, reclaimchicago.org has all the information. Chicagoprogress.com is a website we started working on that provides a lot of like introductory information, like mm-hmm. find out your ward, find out who your representatives are, you know, little blurbs about what's going on in the city. I'd say check that out. I'm on Instagram. Mm-hmm. It's Andre Vasquez, 40th Ward. That's AndreVasquez, 40th. It's got TH, then Ward. Facebook, right? Twitter, it's Andre Vasquez, CP. So I do my best to be as accessible as possible, right? And mm-hmm. if anyone identifies being in the 40th Ward, which to give people general boundaries are like Clark, west to Kedzie, then like Devon over to about Foster. Well, no, over to like Lawrence.
Mm.
Except it's not a perfect square, because those things are. But if you're anywhere in that area, you're more likely than not to be the 40th Ward, and like feel free to reach out, because I just want to talk to, like I said, neighbors.
Yeah.
We're like a block outside of that, which is a
tough really? Scooch all over.
No. Yeah.
Cool. Well, thank you all so much for listening. I've been Dan Johansson.
I continue to be Maureen Smith.
If you want to keep up with what we are up to, there are a lot of ways that you can do that. First, you can head to scopymag.com. That's our website. We post articles all of the time. All of the time. You can check them out. Otherwise, we're on all the social media places. On Facebook, we're under Scopy Magazine. On Instagram, Twitter, Tumblr, Google Play, iTunes Podcasts, and Radio Public. We're under Scopy Mag, and we spell that S-C-A-P-I-M-A-G.
And as always, I'm here to emphasize the importance of donations. We run on a shoestring budget. Everything that we've been able to do up to this point has been through your generosity. So first of all, thank you so much. Second of all, we could use a little bit more help. If you're in a position to give, you can head to our website, scopymag.com, and head to our donate section. There are a couple ways that you can give. You can do a one-time donation, and if you choose to do that, you will have our eternal gratitude. If you choose to give on a monthly level, some cool things will happen. First of all, our next two donors at any level are going to get a free bag of Half-Wit coffee. And beyond there, we're retooling our rewards for different levels of giving. But if you're interested in giving on a higher level or in advertising with us, please feel free to reach out, scopymag@gmail.com. So give a little, give a lot, and if you can't give, then listen, participate, and share.
Cool. Thanks so much for listening. Go out and make something.
Yep.